Hi, everybody. I'm Justin from Toolpath, and this is Chips and Tips. And with me today is the one and only Chris Zappatini.
Yo, what's going on?
If you don't know who Chris is, shame on you. Go look him up on the internet. But co-host of the Within Tolerance podcast, guest on many other podcasts, and one of the best AEs in the country right now in the U.S.
Man. Thank you. The Venn diagram, I would think of people that are listening to this and not listening to Within Tolerance would be pretty wild.
Yeah, probably. Okay, today we are going to be talking about tool library theory and debating about the best way and maybe the one and only way that you should be setting up your tool library.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess
not
let's get ready for that.
Not a controversial topic at all.
Yeah. Let's get ready for the hate comments, the follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
All right, why don't we start with this, Chris? You've been in a lot of shops of various different sort of progressions of how their tool library is set up. What do you think are the biggest problems people run into?
Having one at all, you know?
Right.
I think that's... It is... I think it... In our, generation of, CAM programmers and shop owners and whatever, everybody kind of, hand-wrings about, how to do it at all. And people have libraries, Devin Bodoni, who we were just with last week. Yeah, he has a tool library, and people, his is very, very good. But it's like, can it be better? Whatever, whatever. And then you go to these shops that are making $50-100 million a year, and they don't have a library at all. Like 75 CNC machines and they're like a bunch of Mazex, a bunch of Haas's, whatever. And they're making the same type of parts all the time, and they don't have anything, nothing at all. I think just having one to start with puts you ahead of quite a bit of places. So number one, having one at all is big.
Okay.
Number two, go ahead.
Before we go past number one, I think it's worth just sort of setting a baseline there. So there is a class of programmer / machinist out there that literally has no library. They build up their tools from scratch every time. I'm going to use these tools, and they enter the tool information.
Right.
Which sounds insanely inefficient to me.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, there's folks who have a tool library that just has the tools in it, but not the tools in holders.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a middle ground where people might build up tools and holders, but not put them in a library. But every time they program, they open up a similar file from the last time.
Right.
So it's kind of an implicit library in the sense of these seven tools are always in the files I program with. So I'll start there.
Yeah. And I don't like that one as much.
Right.
So
I think I pretty firmly agree to this. There should be an active choice to establish a shared library for the entire shop.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Even if all you had was as a baseline of even if it was just the cutting tools with cutting data in them. Some baseline of cutting data, that's a good place to start, you know? I feel this should be this will be an ongoing thing, right? Or maybe we solve the world in this one episode, but some assumptions that I would say is the holder, whatever holders you have are good enough. You know what I mean? You don't really need, you don't need power grip. You don't need fancy hydraulic holders or heat shrink. If all you're using is side lock holders and ER collets or whatever, that's fine. As long as, if you're going for it, as long as they're built how you in real life as you have them in CAM, you're good.
Right.
That's the critical aspect of it. You won't be able to maybe maximize your tool for that machine or for the cutting that you want to do, but the goal isn't pure optimization of the cutting. The goal is optimization of throughput, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, that's, you actually hit on two really important points there. First, you talked about cutting data. And I'm not sure everybody thinks about a tool library as encapsulating the cutting data.
Right.
So that's an important note, that tool geometry is just one step, right? So, and in like the three-axis world, there's an argument that like most of the time, you probably don't even need the holder modeled. When you go to multi-axis, it's pretty strictly required. Mm-hmm. I would argue that even in three-axis, you're much better off modeling the holder, because for that small set of conditions where the holder might hit the part on some deep pocket or something.
Right. Anymore, like, this was a worse thing like 5-10 years ago, you know, where you would like have to like physically actually model the tool yourself or the holder yourself. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, especially like in Fusion, a lot of these companies are just putting there's just like a native Fusion library for certain holders and certain cutting tools. Right. Like you don't really have to do anything. The excuse of not having it, especially there's like multiple plugins now, like between Saunders, the NYC CNC, and the Fusion Essentials one, which I think the Fusion Essentials one is better. It gives you like a more true to life size, I found, by a margin that was like surprising. It doesn't, I mean, it probably wouldn't affect you, but we found it at Send Cut Send when we were checking tool length in the CAM program, and it was bombing out. Even though the tool was technically built correctly, like with stick out and everything, our margin of error.
It's like a gauge length thing.
Yeah, our margin of error on the gauge length was like what we saw in like how the script changed the size, which was very fascinating.
Okay, I would say that you and I agree that as a baseline, a tool library should include a built tool with a holder, and cutting data, because like you said, the purpose of the tool library is to speed up the human, right?
Yes.
And also to make things more consistent across the shop.
Right.
So you should be putting presets or there's other, they call it something else in other CAM systems outside of Fusion, but you should be storing your cutting data in the tool library, so that you don't have to think about and like go look at how you used it or guess or make it up on the fly.
Correct.
Okay. So I think that's like a pretty important baseline. I'm not sure that everybody would start at that sort of foundation of the library that we're talking about is tool plus holder. Mm-hmm. And we do that, like we argue that that should be physically matching the actual tool that's built, stick out and everything.
Digital twin, baby.
And then cutting data should be in there. Mm-hmm. So, if we take that as our baseline and you walk into a shop and you say, okay, we're going to start by getting you guys built up with a tool library. What are the hurdles that people have? Maybe if they start with no tool library versus if they have an existing library.
So I have two examples. I can go with like two actual examples of shops that I've, like fairly large shops that I've been in. One of them is like a multinational corporation and the other one is like just national. We'll go with one of them, but they both use MasterCam, which is, I think that's an interesting baseline there. And one of them had a tool library, one of them didn't. And frankly, the one that had the tool library was a worse experience. This is like a very interesting thing too, is like a bad tool library is almost worse than no tool library at all. Because if you have all these tools built up and they're like, oh, here's our tool library, you can use this to program, and then it makes the programming faster. But then those tools aren't built up all the time. Like they're like, well, when we got to the shop floor portion of it, they were like, well, yeah, I mean, we don't build up all these tools. We don't have every tool built up for every machine. And it's like, well, then why the fuck is it here? It took longer for them to build/find the tools that were in the library than it did to just build the tools from scratch. And it's like, at that point, what are we doing? Which kind of like also is another point, like ABA, always be auditing your tool library.
Right.
And so that was a fascinating one. They like had a very consistent, and like they did have like a spreadsheet with like tool IDs that they had like a running list of and everything, and they were trying to log it, but that was good. and they didn't really build tools how they were in the library. And like the one time they did build a tool for me that was like the library, it wasn't correct and it like pulled out while it was cutting. The heat shrink extension pulled out of the heat shrink holder because the correct length of the the quote unquote correct length of the extension to the tool library didn't provide enough engagement in the heat shrink holder. And so it just pulled out, which was funny and very cool. And then the other, so like that was one, and that was like a horrendous experience. The other one was they gave us like pre-existing files to like use the baseline because we were like redoing everything, and we typically try to use like what they already have so that it's not like a massive change for the guys on the floor or whatever. And they just program how they program, and like it's every program starts at tool one, and whatever tool one is whatever tool one is, period, like for that program, not for the shop. And so, and then when they go to the shop, they'll build the tools how they're supposed to be built, but then when they get to the machine, they just like kind of look what's available, you know, and then they just start changing it. And then like, and if it moves to another machine, they do the same thing. And if it moves to another
editing
machine,
the G code,
huh?
When you say changing they edit the G code.
So that everything matches, and then whatever, it's like, what is the point? I mean, it's like, so then you get to this point where cam doesn't match reality, and if it was ran on one machine, it has a different set of tool numbers than if it ran on a different machine, and whatever. And it's like, that is a whole different level of stressor, you know? And so trying to like, we're continuing to like work with them in a different facility, only one of them, where we kind of have like carte blanche over there, like this 3 Mazak horizontal line. And so our approach is now, like typically is whatever we do going forward, this is the baseline of the tool library and we'll start there, you know? And if we, the next parts we do, we'll build off of that and then build off of that. If we bring more parts from other parts of the shop onto this cell, then we will reprogram it to work around this tool library, use the existing tools, and then build on that as we go.
So you identified a couple more issues there that I just want to call out.
Right.
ABA, always be auditing. I think that is a real challenge and a sort of a scare point, like a fear point for people when they think about tool libraries. You know, there are some people out there who keep a very small number of tools built and then have like a number of holders and a number of tools, and they just build them on the fly when they need them. And then other people are, I think the sort of general meta of the machining world is moving toward like, tool holders are cheap enough. It's the cheapest automation you can get. Just keep most of your tools built all the time.
Right.
But even so, even in both of those camps, there's a like reality that the tool library, you're always buying new tools. Sometimes you may have to like lengthen a tool, pull it out of the cloud a little bit more. And so making sure that the library matches physical reality is a real sort of pain point about the tool library process.
Right. And if you're, I am in the camp of like, if you're modifying a tool, right? That should just be its own tool.
Sure. Let's circle back to that one.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. The other thing that you hit on there that I think gets a lot of discussion is the tool numbering scheme.
Right.
Frankly, like hand editing G code when it goes from one machine to another to renumber tools sounds insane to me.
It
like
is
crazy insane.
And like people just live with that because that's just like how it's always been done. It's like, no, bitch, like you should just repost. Like if your post processor isn't good enough that you can post and just put it on the machine and fucking run it, you have a problem.
Right. So, there's a bunch of like subtopics in there. There's like, what tool number should you use? Should you use constant tool numbers? And then people get into like numbering schemes of like, oh, if I, you know, 0 to 100 are my main tools, 100 to 200 are my drills, 200 to 300 are my taps. And then also there's the question of like, should tool numbers be universal across your shop, or could they change from machine to machine or even program to program, right?
Right.
So that whole tool numbering thing is another thing that I think people get very focused on in the concept of a tool library.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is, I don't think that should be the problem that people make it out to be.
No, I agree. I think like anymore, I mean, talking with like Devin or whatever and some other people, I don't like the, you know, these are my face mills, like 1 through 10 or 1 through 5 is face mills and 5 through 15 are roughing in mills for aluminum and whatever. I mean, anymore, it's like, I think the probe should be tool number one, the first tool, which seems like weird, but it's also like that scales a little bit better. If I have a 30 tool machine versus like a 330 tool machine, it's always one. Right. And that obviously like doesn't matter as much if you don't have, if you have a tool or a machine like a Hermela or anything with a Heidenhain really, where you can name tools, then it's probe. It doesn't fucking matter. That's like a separate topic that probably should be with like Dylan or Florg or somebody like that, you know, or Rob. I think that'd be fascinating. Cause like that kind of changes the schema a little bit, you know, but
sort of, but that's actually my point though, is that I actually think that the concept of the tool number, like T7 or T probe, if you're on Heidenhain, is irrelevant, not irrelevant, but is secondary to the concept of the tool library. Yeah. I really like Devin's scheme. I like the idea, and you already said this, like if I have a tool and I'm going to extend it out of the collet, that's a new tool.
Yeah.
So I think that every tool in your library should get a unique ID.
Right.
And we don't have to worry about exactly how you implement that, but my recommendation is like a 4-digit number.
Yeah.
Most shops aren't going to run out of thousands of tools when if they use a 4-digit number.
Right.
And that should go in the description of the tool. And then you, what you can say is that like at that point, like how you decide to number them on the floor is kind of a separate issue, right? If you want to use a consistent numbering scheme or come up with your own system or just number them based on the pocket number, what like whatever you want to do is fine.
Right.
But the main idea of the tool is a unique number.
Yeah. I do. I'm like thinking about how we should like go about this, like because some of these are like whole episodes, like kind of in and of themselves. So I think maybe we just like blast through a bunch of topics and then like drill down on separate ones like later on, because I mean I was thinking about like the floating tools, you know, and it's like probe number one, floating tool pockets or whatever, that's like 2 through 20 or 30, like use the front of it, and then anything beyond that, just from a scalability standpoint, I've also like talking about it this week, it's like you kind of touched on this with do I have a running library that's for the whole shop or is it per machine or whatever? And I kind of think about it, I've been thinking about it more in like the purest like cell manufacturing type of situation where it's like we go to companies that will have like 10 or 11 machines just running the same type of parts all the time. And that's like a cell, right? It's like you could have absolutely like a tool library that's only for those types of machines. And that doesn't affect like a different section of the shop. Cause like, why would I like my Haas vertical and my Matsura 5-axis, why would I want them to have the same tool library? It's very like, it's limiting in two different ways where like I'm building my 5-axis around reach and like variability, where it's like my vertical, I'm probably going more around with like shorter tools, so that I can have better rigidity and yada, yada. It's like, why would I have 4 or 5 inch gauge length in my vertical? I mean, and I don't need it.
They probably don't have the same, even if they're both Cat 40 machines, they likely don't have the same.
Same RPMs, pulstud,
rigidity,
it gets like, it gets to a point of like, I mean, you take standardization like too far, you know, or it's like everything needs to be the same. Like, well, I might use the same roughing in mill, right? I might use like the same half inch AXFPS, but that's in like a 4-inch long PG25 and or like 6-inch long PG25 in the Matsura, and it's in a like the stubbiest, like the 3-inch PG25 and the in the Haas vertical.
Yeah, I mean, I ran into this problem early on because we have a Speedio and the Sile, and they're both BT30. Mm-hmm. They have separate pull studs, so you're not really moving tools between them anyway. But forget that for a second. The same 3ACX FPS, the Sile I have is a single phase machine. It doesn't have much power.
Right.
So I could stall the spindle with the 3ACX FPS. I have to cut very differently with that tool in the Sile than I do in the Speedio.
Mm-hmm.
So what originally seemed like a shared library that I could move between machines, even ignoring the RPM differences, just doesn't work.
No.
So I think I can agree to that, that if you want to think about it on a per cell basis or at least a machine by machine basis, that your library should probably be machine specific.
Mm-hmm.
But material is an interesting one. And I go back and forth on this, and I've decided that I think it just kind of doesn't matter. You can put for a given machine, you can put all your tools into one library, or you can split them up for like aluminum and steel, whatever you want. Doesn't really matter there.
Right.
Whatever is like makes your life easier. I'm leaning a little bit more and more toward like one shared library, because there does tend to be like some tools that you like chamfer mills and drills that you'll kind of use everywhere.
All right.
For the most part.
Absolutely.
And that, I feel like that breaks the like material specific library concept. You end up either duplicating tools or just knowing that, okay, I have to go get some tools from my aluminum library, or you end up with three libraries, like a shared library and a material specific one. But I could see the argument for material specific ones too, especially if you have a larger shop, you want people to know like which tools are safe to use.
Right. I think this falls on like, I think a lot of things will always fall into the like, always be auditing category, you know, because it's like, do like, ultimately there's no like, I mean, there is probably a quote unquote, like strictly correct way to do this. But at the same time, it's like, start anywhere, you know, have like 1,000 libraries, if that's what makes sense to you initially. But then it's like, it's kind of goes back to like the just fucking cut aspect of this, which is live in it, you know, build something, live in it, and then like decide, is this how I like to do this, you know? You don't like, I think that kind of is like a weird like hand-wringing pain point for a lot of people, is like, well, I've talked to a lot of people like this that they don't want to implement anything until they've found like the perfect, you know.
Right.
I've literally had somebody be like, well, I'm always looking for the best thing, the next, like, what's the best way to do it? It's like, but you haven't fucking done anything. So like, how do you know what's best? You haven't done a single thing yet. So like, it's all make believe, and like, it just falls everything. You could spend years developing a tool library, quote, you know what I mean? Like hyperbolically, and then implement it and realize like, oh, it falls apart immediately. And it's like, what was all that time for? You ran years without anything.
That is a key point though. There is a reality to like how much energy you've put into your tool library and how willing you are to like make changes going forward.
Right.
And so if you're just starting out, if you're either rebooting your tool library or don't have one, I do think it's actually really important practice to like limit the scope of that to something that you can play with a little bit. So you might either just pick one cell and focus on that, or even just try to do like, you know, what are the 10 tools? I'm going to focus on a library for like my 10 most common tools or something.
Right.
Or maybe even just like, you know what, taps and drills. Like that's where my library for taps and drills. I'm going to start there, so that you can play with different ideas and get to a system you like.
Yeah.
And you mentioned always be auditing a bunch here. I think that's really important. One, to talk about like how the tool library translates onto the shop floor, but two, to circle back to this idea of giving every tool a unique ID. That ID should carry through, because you need some way to audit what you're doing. And if you have those IDs like in the posted code, then you have a way to like recover what's being used and then figure out like what to audit.
Yeah. Cause can you talk about what you did for Devin?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And how and how that helped.
That was the insight. Yeah. Yeah. So, Devin is the one who I think has talked the most on his own podcast about that tool numbering system he came up with. And it basically boils down to every rotating assembly gets a 4-digit ID number. And that number is just separate, like independent from the number that you put it in the machine. And he puts it in the description in the Fusion tool. So I wrote some code based on our pre-tool stuff that can parse F3D files. And I just looked at like 10 of his Fusion files that he had sent me and pulled out like a histogram of how often he was using every tool. Now, for him, we were trying to look at like what tools should graduate from non-standard up to standard.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like the foundation of a process that is very auditable is that every rotating assembly gets a unique ID, so that you have some way to universally across, you know, different programmers, different programs, different machines, whatever, however you've set up your library, identify what's getting used and what's not getting used.
Right.
And I think that's really critical, because if you don't have some way to audit, then you won't audit. And if the audit process isn't relatively painless, then you won't audit.
Yeah. And then it becomes a mess, and then it becomes fucking useless. And then it's like, you get this like weird, like false negative of like, we tried a tool library, it doesn't work, it's a pain in the ass. And it's like, it's probably a you problem, you know? Just like the implementation was poor.
I think the audit is the primary reason why, one of the primary reasons why that 4-digit ID number should change when you change the stick out of the tool.
Mm-hmm.
I think you want to know, like, did I use the tool like in my library, or did I use some like customized version of the tool that's not my standard behavior?
Right. Right.
Because you know how often that's happening, right?
So, well, I mean, I can think of at least one customer where, I mean, I've talked about this a bunch on with Intolerance, actually, is like me and this guy Will, we would get into like fucking fights about this, because he wanted tool 9 to be 1/8-inch end mill, period. Whether that was sticking out 1/2 inch or 1 inch or 1.5 inches or whatever, that was tool 9. And the guy and that's how he programmed for the horizontals, and the setup guys would just do it. Maybe, you know, they would crash those machines quite often as a result of this. And then the other guy, there was on their robo drill, there was one guy, it was his basically. He retires in April, so TBD, but like if a tool came out, if it was like tool 9, he decided was like 1/2-inch stick out, 1/8-inch mill. If it was built again, that's 109, that's 119, that's whatever. Anytime it changed, he just created it himself and like had all the tools there. And the programmer hated it. And it's like, why? He's like, there's so many tools, it's asinine. And it's like, why? It's easy. Like, that makes your life, it makes everybody's life easier. And it's safer for the machine. Like, because you don't, like, there's no questions of, did I, like, because I've ran into this before, where I started to go with this is with a customer. It's like, hey, we need this tool, we should stick it out further. And the conversation around like, hey, make sure that your tool is sticking out this far, like, so we don't crash, like, just reiterating is like, it's just not worth it. It's just create another tool. Right, is like, this isn't, you have tool 17, we'll make tool 117, and that'll be 1/2-inch longer, 1/4-inch chamfer mill, and then there's no questions about if it's sticking out the right way for the next one or this one, and you don't start to affect other like previous programs that are sticking out at like the incorrect length, or it was sticking out correctly before and it cut well before. Now you extended it going forward, and then you go back to these other parts, and now it cuts like shit. And what happened? And it gets so messy so fast. And I mean, like, that's a different, that's like in a somewhat like contract manufacturing production shop environment where you're like repeating stuff, but you know.
I mean, I think you and I can agree pretty firmly on that. Even on a small one-man shop, nowadays holders are so affordable. There's really no reason, like, unless you're, you know, whatever. I mean, if you got to make your part on a Sunday night or whatever, and it's the only end mill you have left, then fine. But, yeah. You know, just buy an extra end mill.
80-20 rule, baby. 80-20 rule, you know?
Buy an extra end mill. Buy an extra holder. Don't change tool 7 stick out. Put tools, you know, 117 in or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There's really no reason, at least, to reuse that 4-digit number.
Yeah.
Because for all the reasons you said, you lose information for essentially no value, right?
Yeah.
So
I would say negative value, even. Like
negative value.
It is like it costs you ultimately in the long run of like
to like to save like $150 on the cost of a new tool and new holder or something.
Yeah, in some cases it's even less than that. Like Haas is, I mean, depending on the tool holders that you use, this is where like the argument, like, well, I use whatever. It's like, I mean, fuck off. But Haas makes tool holder like makes adding new tool holders like so affordable. It's kind of insane. Right. It's like, how am I getting this this BT30 ER16 for like $15 or something stupid, right. You know? You're like, right. What the fuck is going on?
Yeah. But could you have... Okay, so if we agree, like, basically every tool goes in the library. If you have to change it, it's a new tool in the library.
Mm-hmm.
Can you have too many tools in the library?
Yeah.
Can you go too far?
I think that is, like... yeah, you can go too far. Because, like, well... again, that's a caveat of, like, if you're not going to build it, then it shouldn't be in the library. You know, if it's not going to stay built, at least one is available somewhere.
Right.
It like, and that kind of goes into like a whole other thing, but like if it's not built and available, don't put it in the fucking library. That just lives in that is a non-standard tool. It lives in the CAM file. Whenever that comes up, you have to like deal with that situation. Mm-hmm. But like, putting, because I've worked at a place like before I started ZC, we put every fucking tool we built, period, no matter what it was, went into the library. Mm-hmm. Which again is like seemingly, oh, sick. This is like you're building a system, you're dialing in, whatever, whatever. And every single time, almost every program, you would start using these tools that are like seemingly perfect, and it's like, oh, we don't have that. That's not like that. That's not built. Like that was for a job 2 years ago. We don't even have that shit in the building anymore. And it's like, well, why is it in the library? You know, and like having a like it's like the stock, like where you have stock standard, stock special type of shit, where it's like, yeah, this is like a standard tool, but it's a like quote unquote standard tool, but it's not a built standard tool versus a standard tool that is built, is like an interesting concept, you know?
Sure. Yeah. Definitely for bootstrappers or people who are starting out, maybe don't have, you know, 100 holders lying around.
Yeah.
I think the distinction between like tools that you are committing to be like willing to build at a moment's notice. Mm-hmm. So you have like a stash of consistent ER holders and then a drawer of tools that, and you'll just put them together and, mm-hmm. and it'll be fine. But I think you're right that like every shop has that other drawer of like tools they bought for a specific job, key right. seat cutters, weird chamfer mills, super long reach lollipop cutters, whatever. And I think that especially when you're just starting out, like when you don't have the main sort of like tools you use every day, part of your library built, just completely separate the other part of it. Like, don't even worry about that. Call that a separate issue. You have a spreadsheet. Oh, like, basically pretend like you're buying those tools yeah. in the moment you need them.
Right.
Buying them from your own drawer.
This is like an interesting thing, because I was talking to Graham Francis about, like, mm-hmm. tool storage, you know? He's been really on right. this tool storage thing. And mm-hmm. it's because, like, every tool that they have, it gets a unique ID. They've been doing this, whatever, whatever. And then, like, speaking about it, like, going too far, it's like, well, we have all these tools and we're running out of space. And it's like, do you use all those tools all the time? Do they need right. to be, like, organized in a way that you can get to them? Like, are some of the... Like, you are a job shop, and they do job shop work occasionally, and they used to do it mm-hmm. a lot more, but like, you have all these tools that you bought for a job that you put into your tool library, and it hasn't, and it is organized and whatever, whatever, but like, are you using them? You know, like, do they deserve to have the space that that's committed to? Like, I mean, anymore, like, shop space can be pretty valuable, you know, like, mm-hmm. like adding a toolbox is a decision. Like, he is like making some pretty intense, putting a lot of effort into finding like the right tool solution, because he like space is at a premium and is like, what do I do with all these tools that I have? And like, like the you know, Japanese mindset court is like, do you need another box or like can you clean your shit? You know, like,
right.
Do you, like, and that is, again, always be auditing, always be auditing. Like, I put this tool in the library. When was the last time I used it? Like, do I need, like, can this go from the main storage to like, I just have a drawer full of fucking junk that I know is like here kind of thing.
That's so Devin and I talked about that a lot. And there's some interesting work that I think Toolpath could do to help make that auditing process easier, to like track what tools you're actually using. But also, sometimes there are simpler solutions. I actually forgot to do it before I left his shop, so I'll have to go back and do it for him. But you could just take a like a little piece of like colored electrical tape and stick it on every tool, right? And just tell people, hey, like take the tape off when you use the tool.
Yeah.
And then let's say you have like four colors of tape and you just rotate them once a week.
Mm-hmm.
So every tool gets a piece of tape at the start of every week. And then, you know, once a month you go and look at tools that have four pieces of tape on them.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess I'm not using this very often. Let me move that into long-term storage.
Yeah.
So there are techniques that I think people can use to like manage the sort of overgrowth of their tool library.
Mm-hmm.
And as a general rule, I would say, I actually like the idea of like Kanbaning your tool holders. So, and you brought it up, like people say, oh, I use Power Grip or I use, you know, Shunk Tendo or whatever.
Yeah.
And not every shop can afford to just keep like a pile of those unbuilt, ready to go. If you can, great. If you can run every tool in Power Grip, cool. And shrink is another good example, because that has to be for the holder or for the tool, right? So it's really hard to keep a stable of shrink tools. Maybe you're lucky and you can keep like 1/8 inch shrink till for all your micro milling or something. But also just like keep some ER collets around for. Or like hydraulics with the collet adapter or whatever for your build up random tools thing. And just don't be afraid to like, okay, this tool is graduating into my main library. I'll invest in the more expensive holder then.
Right.
So I think you could establish like, just as a baseline, you could say like, okay, I'm always going to keep three ER16 and three ER32 holders in this box. I'm going to Kanban that. And anytime one gets taken out, I got to order another holder.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives you the ability to just build tools when you need them. And then